This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, at Google Play Music, at Reason.com, or anywhere else you like to listen to podcasts. Rate and review us while you're there. We are broadcasting a recording from Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual gathering of libertarians held every July in Las Vegas. About 2,000 people are. I am sitting down with John Mackey, the co-founder and CEO of Whole Foods Market, and Alexander McCobin, who is the CEO of Conscious Capitalism, a nonprofit that is talking about how to bring some of the ideas that John brought through to the market through Whole Foods to a larger audience and a different audience. Guys, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having us on, Nick.
So, John, why don't you start out, sketch out briefly, what is conscious capitalism as a kind of philosophical idea or practice?
Well, the shortest answer is conscious capitalism is engaging in business in a more conscious or aware way. And then if you dig a little deeper beyond that, we get into our four pillars. The first pillar being every business has the potential for a higher purpose that goes beyond only making money. And secondly, that there's stakeholders that matter in the business besides only the investors. So customers, employees, suppliers, investors, communities that business is part of, they all matter as well. And business should, in a more conscious way, attempt to create value for all of those major stakeholders, primary stakeholders. Third, that we need a different kind of leadership in today's world, a leadership that is less self-aggrandizing in terms of its, I'm going to get mine. We need more authentic leaders who are have high integrity, more open-hearted, and more of a servant leaders who serve the higher purpose.
So fewer Harvey Weinsteins and more John Mackeys.
I don't know about the John Mackeys, okay, but yeah.
Or Dennis Kozlowski or Ivan Boesky or, yeah.
Yeah, I won't argue with the first one.
Okay.
And then fourth, we want to create cultures in our organizations that allow people to reach their highest potential and flourish. And since we spend a good percentage of our time at work, those work environments matter a great deal.
So, and especially as work, I mean, partly because, I mean, a company like Whole Foods does have stated higher purposes. It's not just that we're spending more time at work, but it's also that our work expresses our values as an employee, as a customer. I mean, people shop at Whole Foods because they like the way that you track stuff, the way that you talk about things, all of that.
People shop at Whole Foods for an infinite number of reasons, but many of them shop for those reasons. So, I think purpose is the one that is probably the most important.
It's
one.
It's fascinating to me, and you'll recall even better than I do. I think it was in 2005 in Reason Magazine, you engaged in a debate with one of your intellectual heroes, Milton Friedman, and also T.J. Rogers, the then CEO of Cypress Semiconductor, who was famous in libertarian and actually in business circles for telling nuns that had bought stock in his company so that they could go and lecture him at a stockholder meeting, that he told them, hey, sister, you don't know anything about job creation, et cetera, get out. But that debate was fascinating because in a lot of ways, at least certainly within the Reason universe, it brought your vision of, I think people had been shopping at Whole Foods and whatnot, but it brought that vision that was not simply based on brutal homo economicus kind of activity. So that's 13 years ago. Do you think you've kind of won that debate? Very few people, it seems, whether they're hardcore libertarians or anywhere else on the spectrum, are saying, oh, no, you know, the function of business properly is simply shareholder outcomes.
I don't think we've won the debate. I think in the last 13 years, I think more and more people are beginning to see it our way. I get, honestly, the biggest pushback when I come to Freedom Fest.
Yes.
I'd say the hardcore libertarians don't believe that. Although people that run businesses tend to believe it.
Yeah.
It's ideologues who tend to resist
it. But is it just another kind of slick form of marketing? And maybe that's not a bad thing. And I don't necessarily mean it as pejorative. It's like, you know, because you can go to Kroger, you can go to Whole Foods, you can go to Walmart and get roughly analogous products. I mean, not exactly the same, but, you know, you give people a reason to go to Whole Foods partly because of the mission or the symbolic activity that's going on.
Well, I mean, I think you can make the case that Walmart, Kroger, and our other competitors are also motivated by higher purposes. I mean, I think the best way to try to explain it is in terms of a metaphor or analogy. So my body has to make red blood cells or I'll die. It doesn't therefore logically follow that just because I must make red blood cells that the purpose of my existence is to make red blood cells. Similarly, all businesses must make profits or they will die. But it doesn't therefore follow that the reason the business exists is to make profits. And I think that's what people don't understand. And I think it's because the enemies of business and the enemies of capitalism have put business and capitalism in a very narrow box, that it's all about greed, it's all about selfishness, it's all about just money, 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 because that's how they want to see business. I found that people want to see that about Whole Foods as well. So there's a deep cynicism out there in the world that thinks business is basically not good, it's bad. And so I think business people and economists fall into the trap. They say, yeah, it is all just about money. Get over it. When I've known lots of entrepreneurs in my life, hundreds, very few of them started their businesses primarily just to make money. They had some kind of dream or vision they wanted to realize.
So, Alexander, that's a good moment to bring you into this conversation. You started, maybe 15 years ago, excuse me, Students for Liberty, which is now a massive student-based libertarian organization that is on campuses everywhere, holds conferences all over the world, brings people in to talk about the ideas of liberty and freedom. That was one dream. You're now CEO of Conscious Capitalism. What is the goal of that organization?
So what drew me to Conscious Capitalism in the first place is that the philosophy emphasizes the human nature of capitalism and business, how this is a truly human endeavor. So as an organization, we're committed to elevating humanity through business, which means we're trying to build a community of business leaders who understand the potential of business as a force for good, bring them together to provide support for one another, and then help deepen their understanding and practice of conscious capitalism in their businesses to be the best representatives of the system that they
can
be.
So who are some of the people that are involved, companies or CEOs that are particularly active with you?
So in addition to Whole Foods, we have some other notable companies like the Container Store that have been involved with us from the very beginning. We also have a lot of companies that are mid-market, like Driver Select based out of Dallas or Improving in the Dallas area as well. And many startups that are actually trying to infuse this into the DNA of their companies from the beginning.
Oh, which is fascinating because I know, and I'm forgetting his name now, Virginia Postrel, my predecessor at Reason. I talked to her a while ago, and there's a business economist or something who talked about how organizations, even when you try to evolve and change and adapt and grow, it is true that you most of the time you can't get past whatever was in the mix, in the petri dish at the beginning, and there are limits. Particularly, this guy, I guess, was talking often about philanthropic organizations. But so that's really kind of exciting that as entrepreneurs and as founders are starting to build out companies, they're saying, okay, we need to be thinking in these terms.
Absolutely. And I think young entrepreneurs especially understand that they need to build their businesses this way from the beginning. And as an organization, we want to support them in that endeavor.
So what do you do for them then?
So in addition to organizing conferences and creating these local communities to build up that peer-to-peer support, we're actually offering courses and trainings and case studies to help them understand how to do this. But we don't want to just help the businesses out. We also want to make sure we're sharing their stories with the world to change the narrative about business and society, highlighting all of these businesses and business leaders that are making the world a better place so that people realize how this is a force for good and actually encourage more people to go into business to make the world a better place.
So, Nick, I think it's worth mentioning that one of the common mistakes made is consciousness is on a continuum, right? It's not like some business is conscious and another business is not, or that there's some kind of perfect business that is completely enlightened and you can't criticize it or throw stones at it. No, I mean, all businesses are on a journey to realize their higher purpose and also becoming more conscious. So there are many, many businesses out there that I would put in the conscious arena.
And businesses can fall back, right? Yeah, I mean, like they can be very conscious and then kind of go into sleep.
I mean, Google, usually seen as a very conscious company. Since I would say Amazon, company I'm Whole Foods is part of now, has a great deal of consciousness as well. Netflix and there's lots of well-known ones. But I think Alexander's point's important that most of the ones we can name that we think are well on the conscious capitalism journey, they just never heard of before because they're startups or they're mid-market companies that would be known in their markets but may not be known on a national basis.
Alexander, when you start to tell the stories of these businesses or you know, kind of popularize or bring them into a conversation with either a local community or a national community, what are the sticking points? I mean, John, you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people despise business, or at best they'll say, well, it's a necessary evil, but we really want to kind of constrain it and regulate it and keep it in a box. What are the types of things that you run into when you're telling a story about whether it's Whole Foods or the Container Store or whatever? Like, look, this is what they're doing, and it's pretty interesting, and you should be not uncritical of it, but appreciative of it. What are people saying? No, you're full of beans here.
Well, from the start, when I say the name conscious capitalism, I often hear, isn't that an oxymoron? And that's actually what we're trying to undo. That's the whole reason we exist. When we talk about these individual businesses, I often hear, well, they're only doing that, as you said before, to maximize profit. This is just another way to try and serve the shareholders' interests, as though profit is a bad thing. Or they think conscious capitalism means profit is bad. So we actually have to do education on why profit is a good thing. As John said, it's like having red blood cells. It may not be the purpose for a business's existence, but it's not a bad thing. We actually don't even say that companies should sacrifice profits, but that this is a better way to maximize profits in the long term. And it creates so much value for everyone else at the same time.
Was there a period for either of you, when you look back in history and, you know, capitalism as a kind of defined concept is really only a couple hundred years old. I mean, it exists from the beginning of human history and human activity. But was there a period where business was seen as a heroic enterprise or at least a social good? Or has it always been, you know, a kind of mixed bag where people are like, oh, yeah, you know, that shoemaker is really great, but he's ripping me off and we got to get rid of him?
I know in an earlier few years ago when I was talking to you, Nick, I pointed, and it was controversial, I pointed out how the class enemy of business people are basically intellectuals. Intellectuals and the aristocracies throughout history have basically held business in low esteem. It's what the trades people do. Commerce is beneath us. It's a necessary evil usually performed by minorities, such as the Jews in the West or the Chinese in the East, and they're sort of looked down upon. So Deidre McCloskey says there was a golden era sort of from like Adam Smith's publication in 1776 or The Wealth of Nations until probably a little before Marx. We get into Ricardo, they begin to question the enterprise. For about a 40-year period, she says, and that capitalism had the ascent of Western intellectuals. And that let the genie out of the bottle. And you might say they've been trying to stuff it back in ever since.
And it let the genie out of the bottle, meaning that it pissed off intellectuals who disagreed with them, but it also made everybody richer. I mean, it massively increased the quality and standard of living.
I know. One of the puzzling things when I do my talks on conscious capitalism is I show the charts of how much progress humanity's made since capitalism was let out of the bottle. It's unbelievable. Most people have no idea.
Oh, it's
because
a flat line.
Because all you hear today is doom and gloom stuff. You hear rants about inequality. You hear, you know, things that aren't perfect or so-and-so has this and sort of envy-based critique. And I always say the book people need to read today, the most important book written in the last decade or so, is Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now, where he so accurately documents the progress that humanity has made that in such a emphatic way, it's really no way to critique it.
Yeah. No, it's like literally 1,000 or more years of flatline existence, standard of living, lifespan, and then something miraculous. And it's not a miracle. We know why it happened. We don't know exactly why it happened, where it happened, you know, at what pace, but Yeah, it's a hockey stick and it goes straight up.
It is.
Can I, Alexander, I mean, particularly with Students for Liberty, which quickly became an international organization, which is exciting because, you know, for all we bitch and moan about stuff in the U.S. or in the OECD, the developed world, even, you know, Sweden, France, America, like we're not all, you know, Japan, we're not all that far apart in many ways. But then in the, you know, the rest of the world, there's a lot of stuff going on. Do you find, is there the same animosity against business in the developing world? Or is it an easier sell to say, hey, you know what, like business can have multiple purposes and, you know, and conscious capitalism makes sense?
It's really a mixed bag. Conscious capitalism is just beginning to really become an international organization. I was in Barcelona earlier this week for our very first European conference with over 300 business leaders from across the continent and several other continents as well. And it's almost as though every country has a competition to say that people hate capitalism more there than I find. But it's almost universal that there are pockets of society that despise capitalism, distrust it, and there are pockets that really understand and revere it. And you even find these principles in the history of each culture that business leaders are able to point to. We had the chair of the First Bank of Nigeria speak at the conference in Barcelona, and she actually talked about conscious capitalist principles as being deeply rooted in Nigerian and African history, and how that actually is something that they are going to be interested in pushing forward more because they see how this actually ties in with what they're used to. So I think there is the potential for us to emphasize how conscious capitalism has been there in a lot of cultures and a lot of histories around the world for a long time. And this is just a new way of articulating it and a clear way to articulate it that can be understood universally across the globe.
Do you have an interest in I don't want to say capturing or infiltrating because it wouldn't be that. I mean, but having dialogues with business schools and MBA programs or And I guess, you know, I mean, because this is where a lot of values get institutionalized. I don't know that anybody who goes through an MBA program takes on the values of that program. But is that a fertile ground to reach kind of entrepreneurs or the next kind of several generations of business leaders?
It's an important area for us to work. I don't know how receptive some business schools are going to be to this, though, because the whole idea that businesses exist to maximize shareholder value has been largely institutionalized in business schools. They're the ones who teach this. The academics are the ones who developed that theory and have been teaching it to the next generation of business leaders for decades. And for us to come in and say that is wrong, it upends everything that they know and they're used to. So I think there are some that are going to be receptive to that. I think a lot of the students are very receptive to this that we need to work with. But it's an uphill battle for us there, actually.
Yeah, John, so, when you talk to students...
Think about this for a second. Think about... I find this very interesting. Who teaches in medical schools?
Doctors, I assume.
Yeah. Who teaches in law schools?
Right. Lawyers.
Who teaches in business schools?
Yeah. You got me.
Intellectuals,
yeah.
Not
although in
business
law schools,
people.
Oftentimes it is also where it's you graduate from law school and you get a job teaching in law school without really practicing law. So it's somewhat
perhaps,
similar.
But they generally have
point,
to pass the
point
bar.
Taken. Point taken. Yeah. So do you when you talk? I know you speak a lot at business schools, John. You know how are. Can you make generational? You're a baby boomer, right? You're at, towards the beginning of the baby boomer.
I can't escape. I'm
okay,
a baby boomer.
Yes. No, and I'm not asking you to. I'm a baby boomer. But
I always thought you were younger, Nick. I thought you were a Gen X guy.
I thought I was too, but people keep telling me, and as I get older, they keep telling me you're not that young, strangely. But, you know, from baby boom, you know, kind of leading edge baby boom, the first 10 years, then to the bottom, the second half, then the... You know, Gen X, millennials, can you see broad generational differences that are worth talking about in attitudes towards business? On a certain level, we're in a golden age of artisanal everything. And people do it like you were saying. Nobody, you know, you don't start a pickle company in Brooklyn because you want to make $1 million. It's because you love, you know, making pickles and selling them and sharing them with people. I mean, are there generational shifts that are worth talking about?
I mean, of course there are. I mean, every generation is standing on the shoulders of the generations that came before. They have access to technologies that weren't there before. The social media being something the boomers have latched onto, perhaps, but which the millennials mm-hmm. have been born into and have created for the most part. So there are differences, but I also think there's, you know, it's a cycle thing. I mean, most young people start out idealistic. They want to change the world. Then they get married. Then they have children. And then they leave
their parents' house, right? Then they get a part-time job. Yeah.
So every generation's different, and yet they go through the similar type of changes that, and when you go through the normal life cycle, that tends to change people's attitudes and beliefs.
You know, it's interesting when you think of, and I know the story of Whole Foods pretty well from conversations and reading your work on it and whatnot, but you know, you weren't standing on the shoulder. I mean, you were in some way. You were standing on the shoulders of the generation of business that came before you. But the last place you would have wanted to work was an IBM or an AT&T or a Boeing. You were part of the revolution that changed it. So casual Friday is every day, and that, you know, what it's about is like people developing unique cultures and diverse cultures. Did that come first, and then you elaborate, like you understood there's a theory here that you started working out that ultimately became conscious capitalism?
Well, first, I like to make the claim, Nick, that I was the first Fortune 500 CEO that wore shorts to work. I really feel like I was a trendsetter for that. And so every day was casual day at Whole Foods. So, and then the Silicon Valley.
And yet people can't see this, but you are wearing a suit and tie.
When in Rome, do as the Romans do. So dress doesn't matter. It's just try to, wherever I am, not make people uncomfortable. Right. So, fundamentally, I'm an entrepreneur. I self-identify as an entrepreneur. So I didn't take any business classes. I didn't go to business school.
You went to college.
I majored in philosophy and religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are my interests. And Alexander and I sync up on that.
Yeah, because you're a philosophy.
He has a master's
as well.
In philosophy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So I was just interested in ideas. And so I had a wonderful college education, although got 120 hours of electives and no degree. But I just started Whole Foods because I got very passionate about real food and healthy eating. I had my own sort of food awakening when I was about 23 years old. And I just wanted to do it. I didn't think about building a great company. This wasn't a business school MBA thesis that I put into play, which you oftentimes hear Fred Smith's story at how he started FedEx.
Right.
It was a paper he got a D on. It turned into FedEx, showing that maybe those professors don't know that much. But anyway, the point is that in the conscious capitalism just grew out of, in some ways, my own experience of building Whole Foods. For so long, I just thought Whole Foods was this super weird company that wasn't like anybody else. And then as we got larger and I began to meet other businesses, I realized, wow, we're not alone. There are actually quite a few other businesses that think like this. And we ought to get together because they all felt sort of isolated and alone as well. So we created the Conscious Capitalism Community initially just so we would have a place where we felt at home with our peers.
One of the things that I find really fascinating about your, I don't know what to say, like your career, that seems ridiculous to talk in those terms, but your presence on the scene is that this blending of really deep understanding of economics and exchange, and like how do you create value, how do you consistently innovate and change. But then it is the consciousness part. And I know that you're very interested in kind of what used to be called the human potential movement or human consciousness. How did, lay out a couple of the names of the people who helped expand your mind so that your capitalism became more conscious?
That's kind of tricky, Nick, because I've read hundreds and hundreds of books. So there have been so many different influences. I mean, in terms of the consciousness, I'd say the whole integral movement, Ken Wilber, but not solely Ken Wilber. There's a whole line of thinkers behind Ken, including one of my friends today, Steve McIntosh, who I'm working with him and Carter Phipps on a new book called The 12 Virtues of a Conscious Leader, which I see as sort of a sequel to Conscious Capitalism from my perspective. So there have been many influences. I've always been eager to learn. I mean, I still devour books. I still love to engage in debate and conversations. I think when you stop growing, you start to die. I hope I'm still growing, you know, the day I do die, still working on projects, still learning, still evolving, still becoming more conscious. I will say I'm a lot more conscious today than I was 5 years ago. And hopefully 5 years from now, I'll be a lot more conscious than I am today. And I think that's a, with life being what it is, devoting yourself to learning and growing is a pretty good purpose for life.
It certainly, for I mean, games. And you know, this is one of the things you mentioned, Steve Pinker's Enlightenment Now, which draws on many people's work, including Deirdre McCloskey and Ron Bailey of Reasons. We're going to be around for like another 150 years, right? I mean, lifespans are expanding. So we got a lot of time to fill.
You know, the joke I have is that the singularity will hit about the time I get to be 100. So I'll spend the next several hundred years being 100 years old.
Alexander, where is the best place for people to get information about conscious capitalism? And what do you have any big kind of near-term initiatives that are kind of worth discussing?
So I encourage everyone to go to our website, www.consciouscapitalism.org. Our next big event is our annual CEO Summit in Austin, Texas, an invitation-only event that people can nominate themselves for presidents and CEOs from conscious businesses to come together and meet their peers, to learn what their journey has been like and share their challenges and tribulations to gain support from other people. And we're already starting to plan our 2019 annual conference in Phoenix, Texas, that is going to be our largest event yet that I would love to have more people come out to. And we want to just get more people involved. So let us know what we can do to help them go down this conscious journey in their business.
Also, we have a well-developed chapter program where in many cities in the United States and increasingly around the world, we have chapters where conscious business leaders can come together mm-hmm. and meet. And you can find more information about that at the website.
Actually, we're about to launch a new online platform for that community so that people are able to identify other conscious capitalists in their area.
And pick
so
at them. This is, I mean, right?
Hopefully, so you can meet up and support one another and learn more about this together.
Just a final question. Have you guys found that the conscious capitalist CEOs, for lack of a better term, do they fall into, you know, standard political categories, or is it they're not even really, it would be foolish or just uninteresting to categorize them in that way?
I think it's increasingly we live in such a polarized world today that whenever CEOs come out and take political stands, they hurt their companies. I found that out the hard way when I wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal and Whole Foods was boycotted around the country and protest. It's like, whoa, I just was writing an opinion piece. But the same thing more recently, Howard Schultz at Starbucks mm-hmm. got massive blowback for taking stands on
racial sensitivity
and re-education programs for staff.
Which is, and you know, without going into the specifics of the particular incident in Philadelphia that kind of kicked things off, it's, you know, I mean, I would think from a libertarian perspective, especially, people would be pretty excited that business leaders who are like so important to every aspect of our lives are taking stands. Not necessarily that you're going to agree with them, and sometimes it might be wrong, but it's, I mean, that's what they should be doing, right?
They should be doing if people respected free speech yeah. and just saw it as free speech, but instead they get so angry when people express views they disagree with, they oftentimes organize to try to silence them. So it's not business people risk their... It's like, I to get people to understand this, I sometimes say, I got asked recently, if you could do it all over again, would you have written the op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal? And I'd like to say I would, but the answer is I would not. And they're always disappointed. And I say, look, do you have children? Yes. If someone was threatening to kill your children, would you stop speaking? And the answer is, of course you would. Well, for me, Whole Foods is like my child. And when they threaten my child, it creates a chilling effect, which is why they do it, by the way.
But conscious capitalism is hopefully going to change that. That's one of the things we're trying to change. I see this philosophy as one of the great mediators, or the philosophy that people from all political sides are able to actually agree upon. At our CEO summit a couple of years ago, we had Tom Perez, at the time the Secretary of Labor under Obama, now the chair of the DNC, speak and talk about conscious capitalism as the way forward for business. And also Arthur Brooks, the president of AEI, talk about conscious capitalism as the way forward. We were able to have two polar opposites on the political spectrum come together and agree that conscious capitalism should be the future. And I see that as the real potential of this philosophy, to unify people and to really be the driver forward for not just capitalism, but society in general.
Well, we are up.
Well, you know, Alexander made a very important point, which is oftentimes people agree upon the ideals. Where they differ are the methods to get there. And I think what conscious capitalism is trying to do is, hey, we actually have a lot more that we agree upon than we disagree upon. We can work together in constructive ways to make the world a better place. That's kind of the vision of conscious capitalism.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with John Mackey of Whole Foods, as well as the elaborator of the concept of conscious capitalism, and Alexander McCobin, who is the CEO of Conscious Capitalism, the nonprofit foundation. Look for them online. Gentlemen, thanks for talking at a noisy, busy, fun-filled Freedom Fest in Las Vegas.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you, Nick.
For Reason, I am Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there or at Google Play or at Reason.com, wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.